Shalimar, War, and Too Short. Come to Bethesda Theater in the month of August. More information at BethesdaTheater.com.
Good afternoon. This is the Shai Rana Show with your host, Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at WPFWFM.org and WBAI-FM. Good afternoon, everybody. This is the Shai Rana Show with your host, Zain Al-Amin. Today, we wake up to the news that Cori Bush, another politician, has been eliminated from the race, meaning she lost the election when they had basically placed another candidate that AIPAC pumped $9 million into his campaign to defeat Cori Bush just because of her stance on Palestine. This is a loss for democracy. This is a sign of the failing empire. And Cori Bush is not giving in, and she's going to be fighting. My favorite line of her last speech after she found out that she was defeated is that all the strings are off, and also that she promised at the end to, quote, tear down the AIPAC kingdom. I hope I'm happy to have Cori Bush in our corner now to face this failing empire and the Zionist entity that people like Rachel Maddow, who've been for years talking about politics, is not saying a word about the fact that Israel runs our Congress and our Senate. So, with that, I wanted to start today's show actually with the issue of the Anti-Defamation League, which is a racist organization that recently Wikipedia, we've been saying it's a racist organization, but thankfully recently Wikipedia has changed the definition or changed the basically the bit about ADL defining it as a racist organization. And also, even surprisingly, The Guardian has actually also called it a racist organization. And yet, universities across the DMV area are using this racist organization, this anti-black organization. When I say anti-black, I'm talking about this is an organization that supported the police against black protesters that protested during Black Lives Matter. They coordinated the kind of a brutal solidarity between the U.S. police, and specifically in urban areas in Atlanta, in Washington, D.C., in New York, with the Israeli Defense Forces, or the what we call them the Israeli Offensive Forces, or the what we might call the Israeli occupational forces, because in DC we are under occupation. We don't have representation, but our police is being trained by another entity that is trying to keep people down, and they're learning from them how to repress protest, how to repress democracy, how to be brutal, as if they needed that. So here's a bit about what's happening with the ADL, an expert on the ADL talking about it, and I'll come back to introduce the next segment.
Joining us today on Breaking Points is James Bamford, an acclaimed author, journalist, and producer known for being the BBC and other U.S. intelligence entities. And today we are to discuss the inner workings of the anti-defamation for being here.
Oh, my pleasure, James.
Well, I think some people right off the bat might be wondering, civil rights group, intelligence agency, how do these two ideas connect? You wrote an article earlier this year in The Nation in which you described the ADL as a spy organization, as Israel's attack dog in the U.S., posing as a civil rights group. Unpack that for us a little bit, if you can.
I've always thought the Anti-Defamation League should just drop the anti and just call them what they are. It's a defamation league. I mean, they spend all their time trying to defame people who are critical of Israel. That's pretty much what it's been since the beginning. And I was with ABC News for 10 years during the 1990s, and one of the stories I did was on the ADL. And we looked deeply into the organization and found out that it was linked to Israel, that it was spying on Americans, that it was passing information on to apartheid South Africa at the time. There was a criminal investigation launched by San Francisco's district attorney. So we spent a lot of time looking into it and talked to a number of the people who were involved. So it's not just an organization out there to protect people from slander or whatever. It's an organization out there that does a lot of slander against people. And it's never been really brought up for what it's been doing.
You mentioned that they worked with Israel, other countries like South Africa. What are the ties exactly that the ADL has to these other governmental agencies? Is it money directly, or is it more of off, you know, under the table influence? What have you found in the past?
Well, they've had extremely close connections with Israel. It's hard to trace the money because the U.S. constantly fails to do any investigation of it. But the investigation was done by the San Francisco District Attorney's Office. Among the data that came out was that they would spy on organizations that were critical of Israel, spy on organizations that were critical of South Africa, and they would pass that information on to Israel, and they passed the information on to South Africa. This was apartheid. People who were going to meetings, they would infiltrate the meetings of anti-apartheid groups, anti-South African apartheid groups, pro-Palestinian groups. They would infiltrate them, gather intelligence, and then pass that intelligence on to Israel and South Africa. And at the time, South Africa, apartheid South Africa, was getting most of its weapons for use against the blacks from Israel. Israel was the chief weapon supplier to South Africa because there was an embargo going on by the rest of the world. So Israel became the chief weapons dealer. They didn't care about, you know, South African apartheid. They had their own apartheid. So they felt they were basically brothers in the apartheid movement. And they eventually moved from just weapons to go after the black activists in South Africa and the black population to moving towards delivering nuclear materials to South Africa. Israel already had the bomb. They had already created a nuclear weapon. And South Africa had a lot of yellow cake, basically uranium, that the Israelis needed. So it was a trade. You give us the yellow cake, and we'll give you the some essential parts of the nuclear weapons.
That's a lot to unpack there. You're not only talking about working for governments that are pro-apartheid while being a civil rights organization, you're talking about defaming people, spying on people. Can you talk, you know, a little bit about, you know, because you're sort of the preeminent expert on the NSA and all the stuff that they do and the methods that they use. What are some of the parallels in terms of the ADL's intelligence agencies that you've looked into in the past?
Well, the ADL relies mostly on, to some extent, they're extreme opposite. The NSA is extremely secret in everything it does, basically. The ADL is a very public organization trying to get information out there, where the NSA tries to pull it in, the ADL tries to get it out there. The similarities is in the secretive nature of collecting information And at least on the ADL's part, on information that they're accusing people of being, you know, just because you're against Israel country. They don't allow religions into the United Nations. If you're against Israel, you're against the country, whatever religion. And there are many religions in Israel. And that's the problem more recently, is that the ADL has been going after protest movements, students who are protesting against Israel's genocide. I'll just read a couple of quotes here. Staffers, for example, confided to the publication called Jewish Currents, and they explained why they were quitting the ADL. They accused Jonathan Greenblatt, the head of the ADL, of waging war on pro-Palestinian activists. Another one said there's a lot of people of all political stripes at the ADL who believe that Jonathan is doing is reprehensible. So these are coming from the people inside the organization, a number of them who have quit because they felt the agency or the organization, the ADL, is abusing its mandate. Its mandate is to go after people who are actually committing anti-Semitism. And instead, and again, these are the people on the inside saying it's actually going after pro-Palestinian activists and demonstrators that were taking part in a number of the university demonstrations.
So that's kind of one of the points that I want to touch on, in that I think there's, in terms of critiquing organizations that are Jewish, it becomes somewhat challenging to do because of anti-Semitism and this double standard. So I don't want to make it look like, you know, we're just going after the ADL. So I wanted to ask you this question, in that, do you know if other civil rights organizations use similar tactics or methods as the ADL? Are they unique in the adoption of tactics like, you know, this ones from intelligence agencies' playbooks, like just spying on people, defaming them? Are they unique in that sense?
As far as I'm concerned, they're unique. I've never seen any other organization come anywhere close to the ADL in terms of its secretiveness, its connections to foreign governments, and passing on information to the foreign government, and the money that it receives, the amount of attention it receives on television constantly. Jonathan Greenblatt is constantly on television. There's no other organization anywhere near that comes anywhere close to the ADL in terms of influence.
Yeah, it's kind of a weird dichotomy, I think, because they're very secretive in some of the methods and tactics that they're using, but they're also openly bragging on television about what they're doing. It's quite interesting. Like they've bragged very openly about their influence in big tech and how they can influence algorithms. They've also worked really hard to foster close relationships with law enforcement in the U.S. So all of this combined, and, you know, in your view, how do the ADLs, you know, how do their activities, these relationships that they've built up, how does that impact? Is this a violation of civil liberties, privacy rights? How do you view this entire apparatus?
Well, I view it as propaganda coming from Israel. I mean, that's where this all begins and ends in Israel. A lot of the money are from pro-Israeli organizations. A lot of the information goes to Israel. A lot of the suggestions for influence comes from Israel. I mean, that's what the people on the inside were saying. So it has enormous power because the American press has been extremely reluctant they just dropped the ball and going after anything dealing with Israel. I've been writing about it for years. In every one of my books, I'll have something in there about Israel, and that's the only thing that I'll usually get pushed back on. I can write about all the intelligence agencies, NSA and so forth. But if I write a chapter on Israel, that's what's going to be pushed back. I'll get pushed back on. So that's the nature of it. I was lucky when I worked for ABC News that they had no problem of me. Matter of fact, the person I work with Peter Jennings was very aggressive at going after Israel, and I was very happy to work with him. I was over there doing stories. I was shot at by settlers with a Uzi machine gun, so I've had a fair amount of experience in doing this, and that's one of the things that I've discovered is how reluctant people are to take on Israel.
Yeah, I want to play devil's advocate for 1 second, because a lot of people, they tie this Israel that you're talking about with Jewishness. This anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism, this idea. And, you know, similar to the rationale I think other intelligence agencies have used, which is that, hey, all this spying, we admit to it, all this is justified because we need it to protect, you know, in that case, in the case of intelligence agencies, American lives, American citizens, national security. In this case, the ADL is using kind of the same logic here, that we needed to protect Jewish lives, which are inherently tied to Israeli sovereignty and these kinds of things. Would you say, you know, how would you respond to critics who argue that the ADL's methods are justified to fight anti-Semitism, because this case is a very unique form of hate?
Well, no organization has the right to lie or to abuse people's reputation simply because they feel it's important, or press foreign propaganda. I mean, these are all the things that managed to get them kicked off Wikipedia, which really isn't that easy to do. I mean, so if Wikipedia, and you know, these are people, these are editors that spend all day, all their time looking at Wikipedia entries and try to decide what's true and what's not. But, you know, I'm not the first and only one to come out criticizing the ADL. There's been lots of people that have criticized it for the same reason, which is why the Wikipedia and so forth and other groups are just dissing it, because it has no credibility. And I hardly ever use the word Zionist. I mean, I talk about Israel. You know, that's the country I was in. I wasn't in Zion or whatever. I was in Israel. People who were shooting at me were in Israel. The country that I wrote about in my books is Israel. Whatever religion they are, fine. But this is a country that's committing the genocide in Palestine.
Yeah, I think the Wikipedia development is quite extraordinary, given, you know, the long history of the ADL and the amount of influence it has within establishment powers, whether it be the government, private sector, the media. More specifically, if the audience doesn't know, the recent developments at Wikipedia is that editors at Wikipedia have voted to label the ADL as a generally unreliable source on the Israel-Palestine conflict, which means that they don't think the ADL should be cited in Wikipedia articles on that topic. Furthermore, I think the ADL also faces an upcoming vote at some point in the near future from editors to potentially label the organization as unreliable on the topic of anti-Semitism, which is kind of wild. So what do you foresee in terms of the ADL and their apologies, or now that all this information is out there, you know, how do you think?
Well, I think the money will keep rolling in. It always has, the huge money. I mean, you can see the money that's going into this current election, for example, from pro-Israeli AIPAC and so forth. So there's huge amounts of pro-Israeli money out there that these people are happy to put towards pro-Israeli causes. So I can see the money still coming in. On the other hand, the credibility is going out. So the money may still be coming in, but the credibility is going out the window. I mean, if you get to the point where Wikipedia basically, you know, gives you a kick and says, you know, we don't like what your act is, then you better start changing your act, or even more people are going to start discrediting your actions.
I think these are just super super important discussion to have, Mr. Bamford. Thank you for joining us today. I was wondering if you have anywhere you want to point folks to if they're interested in more of your work.
Well, I've written 5 books. I'm working on another book right now, but my books are all available on Amazon and other organizations. I've written a lot about the intelligence community, particularly the most secret parts. And people really should know capabilities are of some of these organizations. These organizations that a lot of times pay no attention to laws, and they just think they're almost a law unto themselves. My first book, I was threatened twice with prosecution for writing it because nobody had ever written a book on NSA before. When they found out I didn't break any laws, they went away. But yeah, that shows you the amount of protection that they want to give to these organizations. And then I'm writing more recently for The Nation on what's going on in Gaza, and also but in my past, I was a columnist for Foreign Policy Magazine. I've written for New York Times, Washington Post, almost endlessly for a long time. So there's a lot out there.
All right, James Bamford, everybody, worth the follow, I believe.
Boys, love to thank you for your time and keep on tuning into Breaking Points.
You just listened to a segment on the Anti-Defamation League and how it's being exposed right now as a racist organization. And we're going to listen now to another segment that basically highlights what's happening between Lebanon and Israel right now, these rising tensions. And this is a segment that basically lays out what is the reality that's not being reported in Western media about Lebanon. And this is a great take from a reporter and a commentator by the name of Ghadi, who is an expert on the issue and has lived through several wars in Lebanon, to talk about what is happening in terms of these tensions and what is expected from Lebanon and specifically from the Lebanese resistance in response to the recent incursions on its sovereignty and assassinations on its land. So let's have a listen to that.
Thank you. أناديكم أناديكم أشد على أياديكم وأبوس الأرض تحت نعالكم وأقول أفديكم
وأهديكم ضياء عيني ودفء القلب أعطيكم
وأهديكم ضياء عيني ودفء القلب أعطيكم
فمأساتي التي أحيا نصيبي من مآسيكم
وأهديكم ضياء عيني ودفء القلب أعطيكم
فمأساتي التي أحيا نصيبي من مآسيكم
أناديكم أشد على أياديكم وأبوس الأرض تحت نعالكم وأقول أفديكم أناديكم أشد على أياديكم وأبوس الأرض تحت نعالكم وأقول أفديكم
أنا ما هنت في وطني ولا صغرت أكتافي
أنا ما هنت في وطني ولا صغرت أكتافي
وقفت بوجه ظلامي يتيما عاريا حافي
أنا ما هنت في وطني ولا صغرت أكتافي
وقفت بوجه ظلامي يتيما عاريا حافي
أناديكم أشد على أياديكم وأبوس الأرض تحت نعالكم وأقول أفديكم أناديكم أشد على أياديكم وأبوس الأرض تحت نعالكم وأقول أفديكم
حملت دمي على كفي وما نكست أعلامي
حملت دمي على كفي وما نكست أعلامي
وصنت العشب الأخضر فوق قبور أسلافي
حملت دمي على كفي وما نكست أعلامي
وصنت العشب الأخضر فوق قبور أسلافي
أناديكم أشد على أياديكم وأبوس الأرض تحت نعالكم وأقول أفديكم أناديكم أشد على أياديكم وأبوس الأرض تحت نعالكم أناديكم أناديكم أناديكم
Good afternoon, everybody. This is the Shaunana Show with your host, Zain El-Amin. Today, we wake up to the news that Cori Bush, another politician, has been eliminated from the race, meaning she lost the election when they had basically placed another candidate that AIPAC pumped $9 million into his campaign to defeat Cori Bush just because of her stance on Palestine. This is a loss for democracy. This is a sign of the failing empire. And Cori Bush is not giving in, and she's going to be fighting. My favorite line of her last speech after she found out that she was defeated is that all the strings are off, and also that she promised at the end to, quote, tear down the AIPAC kingdom. I hope I'm happy to have Cori Bush in our corner now to face this failing empire and the Zionist entity that people like Rachel Maddow, who've been for years talking about Russian interference, outside interference in our politics, is not saying a word about the fact that Israel runs our Congress and our Senate. So with that, I wanted to start today's show actually with the issue of the Anti-Defamation League, which is a racist organization but thankfully, recently, Wikipedia has changed the definition or changed the bit about ADL, defining it as a racist organization. And also, even surprisingly, The Guardian has actually also called it a racist organization. And yet, universities across the DMV area are using this racist organization, this anti-black organization. When I say anti-black, I'm talking about this is an organization that supported the police against black protesters that protested during Black Lives Matter. They coordinated the kind of a brutal solidarity between the U.S. police, and specifically in urban areas in Atlanta, in Washington, D.C., in New York, with the Israeli Defense Forces, or the what we call them the Israeli Offensive Forces, or the what we might call the Israeli Occupational Forces, because in D.C. we are under occupation. We don't have a representation. But our police is being trained by another entity that is trying to keep people down. And they're learning from them how to repress protest, how to repress democracy, how to be brutal, as if they needed that. So here's a bit about what's happening with the ADL, an expert on the ADL talking about it, and I'll come back to introduce the next segment.
Given Hezbollah has, you know, is the primary force of resistance in Lebanon and one of the leaders in the region in resisting the Israeli onslaught and occupation and genocide, how do you see this wisdom playing out in their response from here? Because there has been a promised response. There is this new phase of war. What do you think could happen from here, given all that you've said already in terms of the strategic thinking of both Hezbollah and the Axis of Resistance?
Well, I think there's one, just the moment the speech was happening, the moment he was saying his speech, he started winning, speaking about Sayyid Nasrallah, because first of all, it is the most followed speech in the history of the Israeli entity. Everybody was listening to him. Yes. Second of all, the evacuation started. They started evacuating all the centers and everywhere. And since the speech and until the strike happens, they are already anxious and afraid. And this is a win in the psychological warfare. And the psychological warfare is a very big trench of the warfare between Hezbollah and the Israelis, not today, since forever. I mean, I still remember during the 2006 war, Sayyid Nasrallah came out in a speech. We were listening to the speech on the TV. And then he said, "Al-an unduru ilayha tahta." He said, right now, the ship that was bombing our homes and our people and our capital, my dear Lebanese, look at it burn in the sea. And with it, tens of soldiers who were killing you. And so it was a speech. And then Sayyid Nasrallah in the speech announced that the Lebanese resistance was able to defend Lebanon and to defeat the ship that was bombing our infrastructure for the past days. So this psychological warfare, yesterday it started winning for Sayyid Nasrallah, because he said, you don't know what to do, you're gonna cry a lot, and I tell you, it's not gonna be only me, everybody's gonna have their say. So you don't know where to expect it, from whom to expect it. He said it can be from Palestine, from Iraq, from Yemen, we don't know, we will see. It can be from the east, from the west, we don't know, we will see. You are laughing now, but you will cry. This was his speech. So I think if we want to look back at Hezbollah the past 9 months, they have been delivering intelligence-wise a great war of intelligence, of intel. Because the people, there are some missiles with the cameras, the people, the soldiers, the lieutenants that they hit in the Israeli army were known. They knew who they're killing and they knew when to kill whom. And I think the Israelis did the same as well. The battle between the resistance and the Israelis on that front is an intel and technology and a full of vengeance kind of battle. And although it has been revived now, but it didn't start today. It didn't even start 10 years ago or 20 years ago. This is a war of existence for both. This has always been the borderline and the front line for both. So I expect Hezbollah to do what they always did, to do something wise, as in to make them pay, but to be of zero civilian cost, hopefully, and to give them no excuse to come back again and to attack our capital or to further escalate the aggression towards Lebanon. I think they have been doing great work, great creative work, in terms of defeating the Israelis without dragging full throttle aggression on Lebanon. And this is also the Iranian way. I mean, if you can see, it is not unprecedented to have assassinations. Ismail Haniyeh was assassinated and Qasem Soleimani was assassinated. You know, yes. The Iranian embassy in Syria was striked. Aymad Mughni was assassinated. Mustafa Badreddin was assassinated. Abbas Mousawi was assassinated. There is no leader of the resistance that wasn't assassinated like that. So we always see different kinds of retaliations. But like, I do expect that Hezbollah will keep on protecting the momentum as much as they did for the past 9 months. And for that, I am grateful.
And, you know, the word martyr comes up a lot. And I know you've spoken about how top leaders, those who are very public facing, especially inside of the Hezbollah organization, they expect death to a degree, because that is what they are facing in a lot of ways with this occupation. It is mass murder. It is genocide. It's occupation. It is colonization. So given that, though, you know, you talk about the defeat of Israel. I know that there have been a lot of people who are skeptical of this. We're witnessing this moment where at no other point has the cause of Palestine been bigger on the world stage, has had more support. And you mentioned it too, this coordination. You have Iran, you have Hezbollah, you have Ansarallah. They're coordinating now, maybe more than they ever did before, had to do before. Maybe it's just more public now that this coordination is occurring. So could you talk about this? You mentioned Israeli defeat. You've mentioned on other programs Israel, its existence is in very much in question, and it won't exist for very much longer. Talk about maybe how this occurred, and how then does this, again, this wisdom of the axis of resistance come into play? Because a lot of people, when they hear this, they're like, well, then why doesn't the axis of resistance just finish the job? I think that's been a lot of what I hear from my viewers. Why don't they just finish the job? So what do you have to say to that, Khadi?
Well, things are not that easy or simple. You have a full world order that is protecting them. I mean, are we really forgetting that even the people in the universities have been denied graduation because they carried the Palestinian flag? Or like people with the Palestinian flag are denied entry to different places or sometimes lose their jobs. It's the flag of a country, for God's sake. We've become the underdog to the extent that they're not apologizing to being such racists. I mean, I work in a TV where every Israeli claim is news, but every Palestinian news is a claim. We all do. Everybody like our. Well, I don't know why. The only lying part, the only thieves here, the only killers here were Israelis throughout the whole narrative. But this is how it is. I think, first of all, it's so beautiful and nice and romantic of people to really expect from the axis of resistance to be able to finish everything. And it is really nice to feel empowered like that and confident like that. And I have this faith. But I think the resistance never worked when it was impulsive. This knowing when to hit and what to hit and how secretive to be is a part of their success and trying to calculate the next day and the day after and the day after after. I mean, we're speaking now, we are sitting 9 months after a full-blown televised massacre that has been justified mm-hmm. by total lies. There are no 40 beheaded babies. There is no mass rape. The Israelis killed the people in Nova Festival using missiles and airstrikes. Haaretz wrote that. Everybody knows. It is the whole war was there was the drum rolls, there was the warmongers, there was everybody. Kill them all. Terrorism, terrorism. And it was all a lie and a narrative. There was something on October 7. Hamas wanted to get hostages to swap them with the thousands of Palestinians that are detained without any reason, arrested without any crime. Men, women, children. You know how many children have been taken hostage by the Israelis in the past years? You know, you only know Ahad Tamimi because she's blonde. But you know how many Ahad Tamimis are there in Palestine? Do you know that every single person in Palestine to go to school, your kids would be full, like scanned and searched and humiliated and bullied. And it's your land. And it's your father's land. There's an apartheid system. There's a real apartheid system by these colonizers. So what happened on October 7th is still dragging to today, all this impunity and all this audacity and people like saying kill them all, people like Germany or whatever, like they're supporting, understand them, only because this happened. So what would happen if the Axis of the Resistance does something and drags something? We are talking about a lunatic with a tantrum, a war criminal, a lunatic called Netanyahu that has nuclear power. I don't think it's really, I think it's a little juvenile of us to really think that things can happen that swiftly. And with all the blood and the sweat and the tears and the sacrifices of our people, I think we've always been fighting them. It's not mm-hmm. only now. The first martyr, the first person who died, planted the first seed. And the people who are being killed right now as we speak are also more seeds. Every single person is struggling. Every single sacrifice that is happening is a way to the liberation. And I always look at the lesson that we learned from the Russians fighting the Nazis. How many million Russian people died fighting the Nazis? Mm-hmm. Millions. Millions. Right? They speak about 28 million.
28, yeah.
This is the number, and we are speaking like years and years ago. So the struggles for liberation, the struggles anti-terrorism like Israel, anti-colonial powers and colonization and apartheid systems and racism, these struggles take time. They take blood and sweat and tears. And we all wish things could happen fast and we could get some respite. I mean, you know, I was just having, this is why we were late today, Danny, for the interview. I was just having another interview was being recorded here in the office. And at some point, cry or get tears. I mean, it's not okay. It's not okay that this is happening. It's not okay that this is what we're talking about. Do not normalize it. We're not okay. There's a genocide. There's something even more horrible than the things we've heard about or read about. Yeah. And it's happening right next to us right now. And this is not easy. I mean, dealing with that and being able to still fight and to still be there and to still be confident and to still persevere. This is the light and this is the path and this is the respite for now.
Hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, those are all good points. And sometimes you use the word juvenile. I think there may be a misconception and maybe a misunderstanding based on lacking experience at literal war, not just war as we see it on TV or in Hollywood or how the United States, where I'm based, likes to portray war. But we're talking about a resistance war, and we're talking about Israel sitting on top of, suffocating, and of course committing genocide on top of the people of Palestine and the rest of the region, as you well know. So that makes it so much. That's why I love when you use the term wisdom, because in order to fight a resistance war against that, you need to have wisdom. You need to look at this strategically and also fight in a different kind of way, because the consequences of an all-out war, I think we've heard it enough from Iran, we've heard it enough from Hezbollah, they would be just massive because, as you said, Israel is nuclear power. I say this all the time on this channel. Israel has nuclear weapons. They are lunatics. No one trusts Israel anywhere in the world, let alone in this region. So, you know, when it comes to and the rest of the axis of resistance, but maybe we can focus on Hezbollah right now. You mentioned something really important, that Hezbollah prioritizes the protection of people, of civilians, of Lebanese, of Palestinians. Could you talk about this? Because I think the idea in a lot of people's minds about Hezbollah is that they are either a terrorist organization, as the U.S. calls them, or they are a militia group that its primary and sole focus is war. So could you talk about maybe the realities of Hezbollah and this important point about Hezbollah protecting people?
I think one of the main reasons why the Americans are failing in implementing their policies in the region is that they do not want to learn about the people they don't like. They just want to impose the descriptions and with a prejudice, you know? So I'm not saying that you're supposed to like Hezbollah, but at least research what this organization is, what this ideology is, what do they think about, what do they work for, who they are, where they are, you know, just to understand how to defeat them in case you wanted to. I think in first of all, in the whole history of Hezbollah, you can look at how they have been working and how their operations were. I mean, even when they had their leading operations, the operations they take pride in, were addressed and against soldiers and occupation forces. So the United States designates Hezbollah as a terrorist organization because Imad Mughniyeh killed the Marines. But he didn't kill the Marines in the United States of America. He orchestrated to kill them on the shores of Beirut because they were killing people also in Beirut. So for Hezbollah, it's not like they want to go after people all around the world and kill them. They just want to protect the sovereignty of their country. This is their ideology. In general, and in their religious ideology as Muslim Shias, they first of all, to be Hezbollah, you must be religious. There's no such way. You have to be really religious. And being a religious Shiite, it has a certain lifestyle. It has a certain method and school and doctrine. And one of the things, for example, is sharing one fifth of your riches and giving it to the poor, other marital stuff. But one of the main things also is that if you accidentally harm any person, you have to pay for this religiously and financially and material, and it doesn't go uncalled for. And this, I think, really stems into their way in war as well. And when I say they have civilian lives importantly, it's not only Palestinians and Lebanese. They also really mind that they are not there. They're not hurting the Israeli civilians, if they are civilians, because there are no civilians in this entity. But they are targeting military bases that are designated military or intelligence bases. They are targeting military vehicles or towers or infrastructure. So, and this is how they've always been. It's nothing new. So when we say they don't target civilians, they haven't. Before, they haven't. There's no such thing in their history. So this is why we say they don't target civilians. And their ideology doesn't really say that. The problem is that when you say you think every Islamic, and I think it's very unfair if you say every Islamic group is like ISIS, you know, because ISIS is not an Islamic group. ISIS is a bunch of terrorists that were made and funded by some Arab proxies in the region. But I think the American intelligence has always been very happy about the resurgence of ISIS in places. It's always wherever ISIS is, the Americans come after. It's always like that. So ISIS call themselves Islamic. The Islam comes from a book. Anybody can read the book and start saying, I am Islam, and do whatever they want. ISIS went around and killing people, but we didn't see all this talk about it in the when ISIS really killed the Syrian people, really killed masses of Syrian people. But nobody spoke about it in the mainstream media because they don't like Bashar al-Assad. Because they wanted to overthrow Bashar al-Assad, even if ISIS is there. So now they come, they say they have a problem with Hezbollah because they are Islamic. Really? Where did you see them harm you? They only harmed the Israeli colonization, and they harmed the American well-being in colonizing the region. So you're only talking like that because you are pro-American policy in the West Asia or in the Middle East. And let me tell you, I mean, the Americans know, and we know, and everybody knows now in the world what the Americans did in Iraq and how they made all the, that thing up to come and to confiscate the Iraqi riches and to really destroy anything that is left in the Iraqi community or in the Iraqi state. So the Americans, when they call someone terrorist, they have zero credibility, not only for us in the Middle East, for the world. The era of ruling alone, the singularity, you know, the unilateral world is done. And because it's done, they are doing all this this thing that they're doing to Europe and to Ukraine and to themselves, trying to defeat Russia, which would never happen. It's never going to happen. They're never going to defeat neither Russia nor China nor Iran. They're never going to defeat everyone because the unilateral world has ended. They can't even function alone anymore. They can't even manufacture alone anymore. The world has changed, but they still need some time to understand. I mean, Hezbollah is Islamic in the ideology, but it is a Lebanese group. It's born in Lebanon, made in Lebanon, helped by the Iranians after the Iranian Islamic Revolution won. But the people that formed Hezbollah were fighting Israel before it. Imad Mughni was in Harakat Fatah. Some people were in the Communist Party. Some people were in the Syrian Social Nationalist Party. You know, Sayyid Nasrullah's father was in the SSMP, my father's party. It's totally not a religious party. That's in the 70s. So everybody in Lebanon was fighting Israel before it was Islamic. It became Islamic after the Islamic Republic of Iran started funding it directly because they also have an ideology about Palestine. I think it's really time now, after all these things are happening in the world and the world is changing, and us, me, you, and our viewers, we are witnessing the change, the big change and the shift in the world from one kind of system and order to another. It is really time to start doing our own search about organizations and people. Stop buying bullies, because there's one bully in the world called the United States of America, and this bully chooses who's the terrorist and who's not. But nobody in the history of mankind has exceeded the terrorism of the United States of America. The amount of people they have killed, whether it's in Afghanistan or in wherever they go. So it's time to change the narrative, and it's time to do my research. How come Hezbollah has a parliamentary majority? Oh, there are people who voted for them in Lebanon. How come people vote for Hezbollah in Lebanon? But also Lebanon is the biggest nightlife destination in the Middle East. Because for us in Lebanon, for me as a Christian Lebanese in Lebanon, I am very grateful for the Islamic resistance that is fighting and protecting my well-being, my children's well-being, the infrastructure of the country, and my ability to grow and to thrive in my homeland. So it's...
For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. Squad House Representative Cori Bush was defeated in an expensive primary battle last night, losing with 46% of the vote to St. Louis County Prosecuting Attorney Wesley Bell. Bush's criticism of Israel's war in Gaza featured prominently in the race, and a super PAC backed by the pro-Israel AIPAC spent $8.5 million to oust her. That same super PAC spent $15 million in June to defeat another squad member, New York's centrist George Latimer. In her concession speech last night, Bush decried the amount of money spent to defeat her.
This was the second most expensive congressional race in our nation's history. And so that's how much they spent in this race. Most of the people of St. Louis, the people of Missouri's first, they sought to divide us.
Missouri's first congressional district in the November general election. In a statement, he promised to serve, quote, the St. Louis region and Congress with integrity, transparency, and dedication, end quote. Tropical Storm Debbie is back over the Atlantic, where it is regaining strength and lashing the coast of the southeast United States. The storm is expected to make a second landfall tomorrow on the South Carolina coast, and is forecast to dump historic amounts of rain and bring life-threatening flooding along its path over the next few days. Debbie has already unleashed relentless rain across the southeast. At least 6 fatalities have been reported in Florida and Georgia since the storm initially hit Florida's Gulf Coast as a Category 1 hurricane. Coastal governors have declared states of emergency as neighborhoods find themselves submerged due to widespread flooding. Debbie is causing storms to get wetter and strengthen more quickly. Debbie is forecast to move through the mid-Atlantic by the end of the week. A federal appeals court yesterday upheld Maryland's ban on military-style firearms, saying the weapons covered in the law are not subject to Second Amendment protections. The court endorsed the ban, saying, quote, our nation has a strong tradition of regulating excessively dangerous weapons once it becomes clear that they are exacting an inordinate toll on public safety and societal well-being, end quote. Maryland passed the gun control measure after the Sandy Hook mass shooting in 2012, when an AR-15 was used to kill 20 children and 6 adults at a Connecticut elementary school. The law bans dozens of firearms, including the AR-15 and the AK-47 magazines. The Second Amendment Foundation is promising to appeal yesterday's decision to the U.S. Supreme Court. A GOP activist who signed a document falsely claiming that former President Trump won the 2020 presidential election in Arizona has pleaded guilty, marking the first conviction in the state's case against so-called fake electors. According to court filings, Lorraine Pellegrino pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor charge of filing a false document and was sentenced to unsupervised probation. She previously faced 9 felony counts. The guilty plea comes the same week that charges were dismissed against ex-Trump attorney Jenna Ellis, another defendant in that case, after she reached a cooperation agreement with law enforcement. Trump himself was not charged in the Arizona case, but he was identified by a state grand jury as an unindicted co-conspirator. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 86 degrees and mostly cloudy. In New York City, 65 degrees with light rain. 65 degrees with light rain. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York.